Well, good morning, all.
Good morning.
Wonderful to see so many people here in the Zendo. But really, what's wrong with us? Why are we sitting inside here on such a beautiful day? We could hiking, walking on the beach, playing frisbee, something like that. But I'm deeply grateful to see you all here. And grateful to see people on Zoom. Hello, everybody. See you. Well, this is kind of an introductory talk because on Wednesday, I'm going to begin a seminar on a long Chinese poem called the Xing Xing Bing, a teaching poem by the third patriarch of the Chan or the Zen tradition named Sangsang. And the Xing Xing Ming can be translated in different ways, the title, but it means faith in mind or trust in mind. And I'll talk more about that on Wednesday, the possible meanings of the title. And this poem, though, is not in our chant book. But it is one of the key teachings left to us by our Zen or Chinese ancestors. And it is chanted at various Soto temples as well as in Rinzai temples around the world. So it has been tremendously influential through all of Zen history. And we can find lines from this poem scattered throughout all other kinds of Zen literature, Zen writings, including the Blue Cliff Record, which is a collection of koans or Zen stories. In fact, it's one of the main collections in our tradition. And it's one of those koans that I'd like us to consider today. Is everyone familiar with what a koan is? Right? Koans are kind of pithy, short Zen dialogues or stories that are used for teaching. Sometimes they're just even one-liners, like what's the sound of one hand? It's a koan. Or does a dog have Buddha nature? Mu, another koan. And sometimes they're longer dialogues, as this one is, that we'll look at. So this comes from that collection. This collection is called the Blue Cliff Record. And it's known as case number 2. It's the second one in this collection. And it goes like this. Zhao Zhou, who is one of the great Chinese ancestors in our tradition, Zhao Zhou taught, "The great way isn't difficult if you don't pick and choose. As soon as I speak, you'll think, that's picking and choosing, or that's clarity. But I don't abide in clarity." Can you live like that? A monk asked, "If you don't abide in clarity, what do you live by?" And Zhao Zhou replied, "I don't know." So the monk then said, "If you don't know, why do you say that you don't abide in clarity?" Zhao Zhou responded, "When you ask the question, you already have it. Make your bow and withdraw." So that's a pretty good example of the kind of dialogue that the ancients had and was recorded. And you may be scratching your head, what on earth is that all about? Well, let me kind of unpack it a little bit, because I think it's kind of important, this idea of picking and choosing, and this idea of clarity that we want. We seek a kind of clarity. We want to be clear. So, this koan, this story, is basically a record of an unknown monk, we don't know who this is, and the famous teacher, Zhao Zhou. Now, as I mentioned, Zhao Zhou was one of the most famous Chinese Chan or Zen teachers, lived during the Tang Dynasty, and his toponym, isn't that an interesting word, toponym? It means a place name, especially one derived from a topographical feature, a toponym. His toponym, Jiaozhou, which means his name, Zen masters, Zen teachers in China were often given the names of the places where they taught, rather than personal names. So Jiaozhou derives from the Jiaozhou region in Hebei province, where he spent much of his teaching career. So all throughout the early history of the Zen tradition, we have all these Chinese ancestors named after mountains, for example, or named after locations where they lived and taught for many years. So at any rate, Jiaozhou was ordained when he was a young man, probably around 13 or 14, in his hometown, which is in Shandong province, for anyone who knows Chinese geography at all. And at the age of 18, he finally met his main teacher, Nanchuan, another very famous, luminous teacher in the Zen tradition. And he practiced with Nanchuan until he was 50 years old, until Jiaozhou was 50. And then he began to travel throughout China, very common, it's kind of pilgrimage, meeting other famous Zen teachers all throughout China. And legend has it that he didn't start teaching until he was 80 years old. Right. So I've still got a while to go before I start formally teaching. 80 years old. And he apparently said, when he began his teaching career, if I meet a 90-year-old man who doesn't know the Dharma, I will teach him. And if I meet a 6-year-old girl who can teach me the Dharma, I will become her student. That was the kind of attitude he brought forward. The other thing I think Jiaozhou was famous for is that he simply used words to challenge his students and lead them to awakening or lead them in their practice, rather than the shouting or whacking them with sticks, those kind of things you often read about in some of the early Zen literature. He was kind of a grandfather figure, I guess. But his name in various collections of these koans, these stories, comes up all the time. He was one of the great teachers. And many of his experiences were recorded and brought to us. In fact, in this Blue Cliff record, the one that this collection, I should have brought a copy in, that I'm collecting this wine koan, he appears 12 times. So clearly history recognized him as a very strong and powerful teacher. He is sometimes touted as the greatest Zen teacher of the Tang Dynasty in China. And this is interesting because he lived towards the end of the Tang period. It was a time when the dynasty was crumbling. There was a lot of, the political forces essentially were disintegrating at that time. There's going to be a revolution, a civil war, so to speak. And more the kind of regional military governors were taking control and fighting with each other. It was a time of chaos. And sadly, Jiaozhou's own lineage, the many monks that he had ordained and given transmission to, his lineage died out because there were many purges of Buddhism within China at that time, towards the end of the Tang Dynasty. But still, his teachings and his stories have come to us today. Now, if you've been to talks here before, you know that Kate and I often talk about Jiaozhou. There's some story about him that we'll bring forward and share with you. And I suspect we'll do this many more times. And I just want to give you a little bit of background of Jiaozhou. He's one of my favorite characters. I don't know if Zen teacher is supposed to have favorites, but he's delightful. So anyway, let's return to the story itself and have a look at that. Jiaozhou taught, the great way isn't difficult if you don't pick and choose. As soon as I speak, you'll think that's picking and choosing, or that's clarity. But I don't abide in clarity. Can you live like that? So Jiaozhou, so often quoted himself in all these stories by later teachers, here quotes the first line of the Trust in Mind poem that I'm going to be talking about on Wednesday. The great way isn't difficult if you don't pick and choose. The great way, of course, refers to the path of awakening, the path of becoming fully alive, fully aware in each moment. And this is just one expression among countless expressions that our ancestors created, pointing us towards the ineffable, pointing us towards what we can't really describe. So in the Buddhist tradition, there are expressions that we often use to stand in for this ineffable, like Buddha nature, nirvana, the absolute, perfection, liberation, awakening, true nature, big mind, and the list goes on and on. There's lots of words that have been used throughout history. But here's the point. Here's what's important. When we come to practice, we don't really know what we want. But we do know what we don't want. We don't want a life caught in ever-reoccurring hurt, dissatisfaction, suffering, confusion, frustration, or dukkha, to use the Buddhist word. Kind of an all-encompassing term. It refers to all those things, dukkha. We know what we don't want, and that's often what brings us to practice in the first place. And this is where we begin. This is the starting point. And the starting point is reflected in the very first, very first talk, the very first sermon that the Buddha gave after his own awakening at Deer Park in India. And in that first talk, the Buddha outlined what we call today the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is what brings us to practice. It is the truth of dukkha. And this is how the Buddha expressed it in that talk. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what wants is suffering. In brief, clinging and aversion are suffering. Now, this translation uses the word suffering, but includes all those other words I talked about before, the dissatisfaction, the confusion, the frustration. The actual word in Sanskrit is dukkha. Dukkha comes from, it actually refers to, the original expression refers to when a wheel is not quite aligned, and so it kind of going along, goes clunk, clunk, clunk. Doesn't that feel like your life like that sometimes? Clunking along. So in this story, in the koan again, Jiaozhou tells the assembly, the people that are listening to him, all the monks, the great way, the path to end suffering, dissatisfaction, frustration, dukkha, is not difficult. Just avoid picking and choosing. Sounds so simple, right? Oh. But just think for a moment of how many times throughout the day you pick and choose. How many times you try to escape what is displeasing by picking something else. How many times that what is pleasing disappears and you try to pick something that will bring it back. And how many times you just don't get what you want. We all try to smooth out our life by avoiding what we don't like, by picking and choosing. We try to pick and choose what we like over and over again. Sometimes it works for a while, sometimes it doesn't. Picking and choosing, it turns out, course through pretty well all our daily activities. And maybe you think that somehow with a lot of hard work and diligence, you can go beyond picking and choosing. And you could work on letting go of your aversions and your attachments. You could train yourself to do without something you think you have to have, like coffee, chocolate, just this practice, right? You could learn to accept adversity without resistance and complaint. And some of that is important to do. That is part of our practice. Dogen Zenji, our Japanese ancestor who first brought this form of practice from China to Japan way back in the 1200s, he wrote this. He said, a monk's mouth is like an oven. A monk's mouth is like an oven. Which we can understand to mean accepting whatever is put into it, like the oven does, right? Put a roast in, put chocolate cake in, you know, the oven just accept it. That's, he says, a monk's mouth should be like that. Receive without discrimination, likes or dislikes. Well, that sounds good in theory. And as I said, maybe with a lot of practice, we could get beyond grasping and rejection. We may think that. But when we sit down on the cushion, just as we've did today, for a long period of time, we observe our minds closely. What arises, what vanishes. We can realize how subtle and constant the kind of grasping and rejecting, the picking and choosing, how constant that is in our life. And deep within, isn't it true? We want to live, and we don't want to die. We want youthful energy, and not the tiredness of the aged. We want strength and health, not weakness and sickness. And it's just the way it is for us. It is part of our human nature. Right? I know when I look in the mirror in the morning, I'm a little bit surprised. What happened to that 20-year-old face I used to have? I used to be very handsome, believe it or not. We conduct so much of our life believing we're in control, that we have the power to choose what to do and what not to do. And we do have some choices. We have the choice not to steal, for example. We have the choice whether to put sugar in our coffee or not, for example. The picking and choosing that Zhao Zhou is talking about is the way we imagine our lives should be, the striving to make our lives different from how they actually are. This picking and choosing refers to the way we imagine we have real choice over what life presents us, or real choice as to how we will respond to what life presents us. For much of our life, we've been making great effort, picking and choosing carefully, trying to find our way out of the confusion of this life. And although we seem to have success sometimes, before long we find ourselves again caught in distress and confusion. So we keep picking and choosing, picking and choosing, picking and choosing, trying to find some permanent stability, some permanent ease in this life. I suspect we're hardwired to do this, to respond in this way. But here Zhaozhou, in quoting this line, is telling the assembly and us to be aware, to let go of that reactive picking and choosing that we do, and instead to meet fully and greet fully what life presents us. This meeting and greeting is not acquiescence. It's not throwing your hands up or going into a dark hole somewhere. But rather a clear accepting of this moment, this situation, and the emotions that arise with it. And then together with this seeing, this acknowledging, this fully meeting of life as it is the willingness then to engage and work with what is. Our bodhisattva vows, for example, our vows to help all beings, our commitment to social justice, to address poverty, racism, inequality, sexism, all of these commitments, our vows, call us to act in the world. However, whatever we confront, whether it's personal suffering, sorry, the doctor says this cancer is inoperable. Or whether it's the devastation we see around us, the climate crisis, the war going on in Ukraine, we have to begin from a place of what the Insight Meta teacher Tara Brach calls radical acceptance. We begin there. Ah. This is it. This is the way it is. Rather than picking and choosing our way around it, rather than picking and choosing a way out of it. It is acting from that deep place within us that goes beyond who we think we are. In other words, I'm not just acting from my own preferences, but acting from something larger, more inclusive, something more embracing, something that's not excluding. Anyway, I'll talk more about this on Wednesday, just because I want to move on through the rest of this little story here. But anyway, with that in mind, let's just go back to the koan. Zhaozhou taught the great way isn't difficult if you don't pick and choose. As soon as I speak, you'll think, that's picking and choosing, or that's clarity. But I don't abide in clarity. Can you live like that? So Zhaozhou is pointing to our fundamental struggle by our endless picking and choosing as we try to meet that imagined place that is surely well deserved. I deserve peace and tranquility and happiness, ease, serenity, clarity. Pick and choose, try to reach there. And in this dialogue, Zhaozhou acknowledges that even when he's speaking as he does, that very speaking may be considered picking and choosing. Or it may be considered clarity. Oh, what great wisdom, so clear. Deep insight. But Jiaozhou recognizes the trouble we can get into when we rely heavily on words. And I suspect he is referring to the famous dictum in the Zen tradition that goes like this. The Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures, not depending on words and letters, directly pointing to the mind, seeing into one's true nature and attaining Buddhahood. That's a famous dictum or saying that's been passed down from the beginning of the Zen tradition pretty well. But maybe Jiaozhou's referring to that when he says, even saying this. But here's the point that I think is most interesting. Jiaozhou says, I don't abide in clarity. When I read this, what immediately came to mind is that those kind of humorous images or cartoons we see of the wise old hermit on the top of the mountain in some kind of complete and enduring peace, dispensing wisdom to those who make the arduous journey up to the top of the mountain, right? Like, that's the goal. We'll all one day end up on top of a mountain in total peace and bliss. And it is true that we start our practice with the intention to travel in that direction of clarity and ease. So in light of Jiaozhou's words, it seems perhaps rather strange. After all, don't we all make the effort on our cushion and throughout our practice, aiming towards clarity, towards serenity, towards the absolute, however we imagine it to be? So what is Jiaozhou telling us here? I don't abide there. Jiaozhou is hinting to the assembly that what they assume to be the purpose and goal of their practice is not quite right. Perhaps he's hinting that continuous, uninterrupted serenity and total absolute freedom from any kind of suffering is not the goal, is not what practice offers us. He doesn't say those moments don't exist. He says, I don't abide there. Isn't it true from the very beginning of the Buddhist tradition, the teaching and acknowledgement of impermanence has been really at the center? To grasp at awakening, however we imagine or experience it to be, is still grasping. And in grasping, we again get caught. Wonderful states of a mind may arise in our practice. And it is important for us to learn how to integrate those experiences when they arise into our daily life, while not taking them as the goal of practice. Now, I have fallen into this trap a number of times, striving hard on the cushion at longer retreats to repeat an early experience. Yeah, last time it was so sweet, you know, I want to get there again. And I know of people, talked with people who hop around to different places of practice, to different teachers, trying to replicate a powerful experience they had earlier, or to initiate some kind of imagined state that they've read about or they think they should get to. And Jiaozhou here warns against our tendency to grasp, to pick and choose, even in our spiritual practice. Well, how the heck do you do that? But then in his grandfatherly kindness, he gives us a clue. He asks a question. Can you live like that? Now, the Chinese when I look at the Chinese, there's no pronouns there. It's not, there's no you, right? Chinese and Japanese often avoid having a subject in the sentence if it's pretty clear what the subject is, or pronouns are often just avoided. So it could be this line could be translated in many ways, like, how do we live this way? What does this mean for life? How do we live this way? The monk asked, if you don't identify with clarity, if you don't abide in clarity, what do you live by? So the monk is throwing the question back to Jiaozhou. And Jiaozhou gives a very strange reply. He says, I don't know. I don't know what I abide in. Isn't the teacher supposed to know these things? I remember asking my teacher, Zokitsu Norman Fisher, what is a Zen priest? And he replied, I don't know. Now, both Norman and Jiaozhou's I don't know is not the I don't know of confusion or I don't know of loss. It is the I don't know of vast openness to the moment. The greeting and accepting of what life presents right now, and now, and now. Meeting that moment free of expectation of judgment, evaluation. First. And then, of course, you need to pick and choose. You need to act. But first, it's like, oh, okay. Jiaozhou is telling us he's not holding on to some awakening. Like, oh, now I got it. I got to keep it. Just clarity. He doesn't hold on to clarity. Like, oh, that's the state I should be in. I should never have any confusion. I should always be clear. Not holding on to that. He's not picking and choosing what to keep and what to immediately reject, but just questioning completely, bringing forth what we call the don't know mind. Oh. And in this way, entering fully into this moment, whether it's very sweet or it's very bitter. But fortunately for us, the monk pushes Jiaozhou a little bit further. If you don't know, why do you say then you don't abide in clarity? Playing with words a little bit, perhaps, the monk. And Jiaozhou, I think, probably smiled at the monk at this point and said, when you have asked the question, you already have it. Make your bow and withdraw. Go back to your seat. I have often talked about the value, the central role of questions in our practice. In my own practice, I find a true question has a force, a power, that the answer lacks. Questions carry us onwards, deeper. Questions stop us where we are, right? Oh, got it. Maybe you feel a little hit of dopamine when you get the answer, right? Oh, I finished a crossword puzzle. Got it all. But really, it's the questions that pull us forward in our practice and in our life. It is the questions we need to be aware of and give our full attention and energy to. The answers are sweet, but they will not carry you through the pain and suffering of life. They will not help you in those tragic moments. It is the questions that will pull us through those times and beyond. In his response, "I don't know," Jiaozhou tells the monk and us that his own life, that Jiaozhou, the great teacher Jiaozhou's own life, is really a life of humility and open-hearted questioning. "I don't know." He tells the monk, "It's enough to ask the question. And after that, it is the practice of the monk to live with it and then let the question do its work." Kind of like yeast in bread, right? You put the yeast in bread and you leave it. You don't throw the dough in the oven right away. It rises, just as these life-giving questions arise within each of us. So let me ask you now. Soon you'll leave the Zendo and go outside, or you'll leave the Zoom Zendo. How will you practice with your mind that must pick and choose moment after moment? Throughout every day, how will you practice with that? And how will you answer Jiaozhou's great question, "I don't abide in clarity. Can you live like that?" Or, "How do you live like that?" Or maybe, "How will you meet what life gives you when you leave this door, when you turn off your laptop?" These are the questions that will allow us to be fully alive if we give them the permission to live in us. How will you meet what life gives you after you walk out this door? Will it be the reflexive, picking and choosing mind that stands in front of the pastry window trying to decide if it's a chocolate croissant or that double baked almond thing or that lemon curd Danish that looks so tempting? We can play with that picking and choosing mind. But maybe there's a deeper place that allows us to pick and choose from our practice, our wisdom, our compassion, allowing that to flower in the world. And we can recognize that. It may seem like a big thing, and it is, but it's also when you meet your partner, your friend, your spouse. Can you let go of the picking and choosing then and meet them from a wider place? Act from a deeper understanding and a place of inclusiveness. Thank you for listening. We'll end the closing chant.